I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A Philadelphia judge orders ride-hailing companies Lyft and Uber to cease operations in the city. The move could potentially shut the companies down in Philadelphia. Details from WHYY's Bobby Allen.
Taxicab drivers have been trying for months to kick Lyft and Uber out of the city. Since the car-hailing companies came to Philly, cabbies have seen their business plunge. The order from Common Pleas Judge Linda Carpenter puts Lyft and Uber on notice. If caught operating in Philadelphia, the company could face a contempt of court hearing, which could carry jail time. Ted Milstein represents the cab drivers in the suit that triggered the court order.
To speak quickly, it will have immediate impact, probably not, but it all depends on how Uber reacts to it, and also depends upon what would happen at this contempt hearing, and which will likely happen.
Now, violating the court order would require the Philadelphia Parking Authority to catch Lyft and Uber in action. They've had trouble doing that in the past, since the cars are unmarked and the companies have blocked regulators' numbers. The PPA won't say whether there will be a crackdown, and if so, what that would look like. An Uber spokesman said the order should put pressure on lawmakers in Harrisburg to pass a bill legalizing ride-sharing across the state. Such a bill is stalled in the House of Representatives, which meets again next week. In the meantime, no one is willing to say when and if Lyft and Uber will go dark. Passengers and drivers don't have much to worry about, though. Lyft and Uber as companies will be the ones liable if regulators do catch their drivers. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
New Jersey is reviving a program that helps residents struggling to pay their mortgages. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, homeowners could get up to $48,000 to pay down their debts.
It's called the Homekeeper Program, and it's open to people who are unemployed or underemployed, or who've had a major life event, like an illness or a death in the family. Benita Holmes works for New Jersey Citizen Action, which acts as an intermediary between the state and borrowers looking to hold on to their homes.
It's another great tool that we have to work with. We previously worked with the program for over 3 years and obtained millions in assistance for our clients.
That's because the housing crisis is still alive and well in New Jersey. According to the data firm RealtyTrack, New Jersey had the highest foreclosure rate of any state in August. Shirley Abreu is a financial counselor for Family Guidance, a social services nonprofit just outside Trenton. She says she doesn't see as many bad mortgages as she used to, mostly people struggling because of the sluggish economy.
Some of the people got laid off or they got cut off. For example, we don't see people that they're like 5 years behind like we used to be. These are people that they've just been behind like 3 months or 4 months.
Residents who want to participate in the Homekeeper program can find more information at njhomesaver.com. The program is funded with federal money set aside for states hardest hit by the housing crisis. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
The election draws ever nearer. No, not that one. Let's leapfrog to November 2017 and consider the changing plays and players vying to succeed Chris Christie as governor of New Jersey. Joining me is Bridget Harrison, professor of political science and law at Montclair State University in New Jersey. Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure, Dave.
Well, this has become very interesting with the announcement that State Senate President Steve Sweeney will not run for governor, instead vying for another bid for Senate.
It is a very interesting development indeed, and I don't think that we've ever had a situation in which the heir apparent of New Jersey's governorship could be announced 14 months in advance of the election.
And who might that heir apparent be?
If I had to bet right now, it would be Phil Murphy, the only declared candidate for the Democratic nomination, who so far has invested about $11 million of his own money on a gubernatorial bid, essentially outpricing many of his Democratic rivals in the process.
Tell us more about Phil Murphy's background.
Mr. Murphy was appointed by Bill Clinton to be ambassador to Germany. He also worked at Goldman Sachs. Many people have compared him to the former governor, John Corzine, who also had a Goldman Sachs background. And the similarities actually don't end there. The way that John Corzine got involved in politics, he started buying up Democratic Party chairs, investing heavily in county races and state legislative races. And it appears that Phil Murphy has essentially done the same thing. When you have other candidates who can't self-fund and need to rely on campaign contributions, and thus have to buy into the state's matching gubernatorial fund campaign, which then limits the amount of money that they can spend on an election, it means that self-funded candidates who don't have to abide by those rules really have a distinct advantage.
We'd be derelict in this conversation if we didn't invoke the name Norcross, and it's George, not Donald. What's his role?
Among the big losers today with the Sweeney announcement was George Norcross, because the North Jersey political bosses or county party leaders unified around the candidacy of Phil Murphy. Many were taken by surprise when Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop bowed out of the race. At that point, I think a lot of these North Jersey politicians said, you know what, anybody but Norcross's guy. It's not necessarily that they had anything against Steve Sweeney other than the fact that he has very close relationships with George Norcross.
Let's look at the Republican ledger in this upcoming race, and what's your estimation on their viability?
I don't see them as particularly viable. First off, there is, of course, Governor Christie's legacy. You have such an unpopular politician as the leader of the political party.
Is this an indictment of the Republican Party or the personality of Governor Christie and his track record?
Well, I think it clearly is an indictment of Governor Christie and not the entire party. The problem, however, is that one Republican candidate, the Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno, her political career is inextricably linked with the governor's. The governor has not spent any time whatsoever building a bench of Republican candidates. And the other problem, of course, is money. The governor has depleted the funds in the statewide political party for his projects, whether it's legal funds or his own travel. And so, therefore, the Republicans don't have the money that could be used to field a viable alternative to Phil Murphy.
It seems that your assessment does not then bode well for Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli.
Of any of the Republicans, he is unique in that he has succeeded in distancing himself from Governor Christie. But really, it is an uphill battle, given particularly the demographics of the state, which does trend blue and is trending bluer simply because of changes in the state's population, but also because of the enormous influence of our political machines. Chris Christie was able to win election essentially because the party bosses were so dissatisfied with John Corzine, and they essentially enabled a Christie election.
Professor Harrison, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
My pleasure, Dave.
Bridget Harrison is professor of political science and law at Montclair State University in New Jersey. ...2016's tumultuous presidential race between Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump is not happening in a vacuum. It has a ripple effect across the world of politics, particularly in Pennsylvania's hotly contested U.S. Senate race. WITF's Katie Meyer reports that the closely watched matchup could potentially decide which party controls the chamber next year.
It's a rainy night in Lancaster County. Thousands of people are packed into a cavernous sports arena. It's hot, there are no seats, and the guest of honor is almost 2 hours late. Nevertheless, spirits are high. This is, of course, a Donald Trump rally. Most of the people here are passionate supporters, and they talk him up happily. But there's also another Republican candidate weighing on many people's minds, incumbent U.S. Senator Pat Toomey, who's in a race for his political life against Democrat Katie McGinty. When the subject of Toomey comes up, many Trump backers have a quite different response.
Shame on him.
That's Jack Lockhove of West Hempfield Township, Lancaster County. He's not the biggest Toomey fan right now because the senator has, so far, not endorsed Trump for president. The way Lockhove sees it, it's a matter of principle.
I think he should have had the guts. He'll probably win the polls and vote for Trump, but he's too much of a coward to endorse Trump.
However, it may be a little more complicated than that. Trump's candidacy has put Toomey in a tricky position. Elected in 2010, the junior senator has a reputation as a pragmatic fiscal conservative. He's worked across the aisle several times, most notably on the failed 2013 firearms background check bill. Toomey tends to appeal to moderates. Trump's base, on the other hand, lies in the farthest right wing of his party, according to pollster and Muhlenberg College professor Chris Borick.
They have very different worldviews on lots of issues, and to be able to just completely align, I think, was going to be a big challenge.
More importantly, Trump's appeal may ultimately be a detriment in Pennsylvania. Traditionally, the Commonwealth vote breaks down in a predictable way. Philadelphia and Pittsburgh go to the Democrats, and the GOP takes the rural areas in between. The pivotal swing areas are the Philadelphia suburbs. They're inhabited largely by college-educated, moderate voters, and Trump has been polling badly there. Borick says that doesn't bode well for Toomey's reelection bid.
If Donald Trump loses Pennsylvania by, you know, 5, 6, 7 points, that might be enough drag to pull Pat Toomey under with him. And that's the dilemma for Toomey. And on one hand, he needs Trump to succeed, but he also has to have some distance from Trump if he's to succeed while Trump might fail.
So what's a moderate conservative like the senator to do? In his own words,
I think it's very important to Pennsylvanians that their senator be an independent voice. And sometimes that means disagreeing with your own party. I have consistently demonstrated I am willing to do that when I think my party or my party's leadership is wrong.
For months now, Toomey has been walking a fine line between aligning himself with Trump and keeping a safe distance. But he hasn't endorsed him. That noncommittal stance on the party's presidential nominee is not a common strategy. Borick says down-ballot candidates almost always tie themselves with their party's presidential candidate during general election years, and with good reason.
It's the standard, and quite often they pair their races together as a way of unifying resources.
However, Borick notes the distance can also be helpful, particularly when Trump makes one of his more controversial statements.
If he did come out and say, look, he's my nominee, and that I'm going to have to rally around him as a good Republican, you immediately link yourself to all things Trump.
And Toomey has certainly taken advantage of not being linked to the GOP nominee.
For instance, when he said we should have a ban on Muslims, I immediately stood up and said, no, that's not how America works. We don't ban people from this country based on their religion. We should do background checks. We should make sure we've checked security risks, but we don't have a religion test.
Despite his tenuous position, Toomey has the kind of backing from the state GOP that any candidate can expect. Vice chair of the Pennsylvania Republican Party, Joyce Haas, frequently emcees Trump events and nearly always works in a Toomey endorsement.
We must re-elect Senator Pat Toomey. Yoo-hoo!
At the end of the day, Borick says it's likely Toomey's lack of enthusiasm about Trump won't hurt him too much among conservatives, even if they don't like the decision. Back at the Trump rally, Jack Lockoff says as much.
I will vote for him, but I'll vote for him reluctantly.
Whether Toomey's tightrope act will pay off among moderates is still unclear. But if recent polls are to be believed, it just might. While Trump trails in Pennsylvania, Toomey's numbers are holding steady. He's virtually tied with McGuinty in an average of the latest state polls. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
It's estimated that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before turning 18. As sobering as those numbers are, simply studying the statistics can serve to diminish the emotional impact. Creating a different way to highlight the horrors of sexual abuse is the goal of Sasha Joseph Neulinger, director of the documentary Rewind to Fast Forward, as well as Abby Newman, CEO and executive director of Mission Kids. Sasha, Abby, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sasha, you are a filmmaker, and the film you are mining is actually a collection of your dad's home videos.
That's right. So we have 200 hours of home videos from my dad. And my dad actually is a filmmaker, but as a child, he wasn't planning to shoot a documentary of my life. He just happened to have the camera around and filmed my childhood extensively.
Your dad was sexually abused as a child.
He was. So my dad was sexually abused by his brother Larry and his brother Howard. Both of his brothers sexually abused him. And he actually, you know, in this film, as I look through all of the home video, it kind of sets me on a journey to come back to the Philadelphia area. I've been in Bozeman, Montana for the last 8 years, and interview my mom, my dad, my psychiatrist, the detective, the prosecutor. And so the question that comes up often is, if your dad was abused by his brothers, how could he let his brothers into the home where you were as a child? And a lot of abuse survivors believe that when they're abused, it's because they did something wrong to deserve it. They're dirty, gross, disgusting, unlovable. That's the belief. So for my dad, he thought that they were abusing him and just him because of those beliefs about himself. So he couldn't imagine that they would hurt us too.
You have a sister.
I have a sister.
And you and your sister were abused, you from the ages 4 to 8.
4 to 8, yeah.
You have the film showing depictions of yourself, those early years. When you're looking at them now as an adult, what comes to mind?
It's been a really cathartic process for me. In my childhood, I wasn't really able to embrace and absorb a lot of the beautiful moments because I was so wrapped up in this cloud of fear and pain and terror. And so when I look back at the footage now, it is hard to watch, you know, this beautiful, open-minded, open-expressive child become really quiet, gain weight, and start to isolate himself, which I'm watching myself do that between the ages of 4 and 8. But aside from these moments where I see myself interacting with my abusers while the secret is still being kept, I also, through the 200 hours of home video, found a plethora of beautiful moments from my childhood that I'd completely forgotten about.
Again, when you look back at these films with your adult brain, are you looking at yourself with that kind of cognitive awareness, or are you back in that 4 to 8 year old child's mind?
There's two different things happening when I look at the footage. There is the cognitive piece where I can look back now after having, you know, 15 years of intensive psychotherapy, the justice that was served in all three trials, all the time I had after age 17 when the last trial ended. You know, there's so much time that's gone by that there is somewhat of a cognitive objectivity where I can look at all of the people in the film and look at the experiences and analyze it. But there's also another piece for me where it's when I watch this footage, I reconnect with that terrified child inside of me.
You alluded to a courtroom resolution. And with that, let's bring in Abby Newman, CEO and executive director of Mission Kids. Your project was started actually by the district attorney at the time involved with the case.
Right. Risa Vetri Furman, as well as Lori O'Connor, who was the director of Office of Children and Youth Services in Montgomery County.
What is the mission of Mission Kids?
The mission of Mission Kids is to change the process of children who have been sexually abused so that when the abuse is discovered, they don't have to go through the torture that Sasha went through in terms of the investigation.
How has that process been reformed in the interim since that case came to the court system, I believe, in around the year 2000?
Well, the process has changed now that with Mission Kids, if there's a case of child abuse, sexual abuse, reported in Montgomery County, rather than this child going to the police station over and over and over again to the foot person, then the sergeant, then a detective, then to the district attorney's office, if children and youth is involved, over to the Children and Youth Services. So now at Mission Kids and other child advocacy centers, all of those people come to us. The child sits with one person, a specially trained forensic interviewer, whose only job is to ask that child questions in a neutral, age-appropriate fashion so the child can tell the story in their own words. And then a recording is made that can be used later on if somebody else wants to know down the chain what that child said. The DVD can be passed on as opposed to dragging that child through again.
Sasha, let's talk about rewind to fast forward. It seems in part that it's part of your ongoing recovery to be immersed in this project. What do you hope others can glean from it?
I look at my case, and it was far from perfect as far as how it was handled. I didn't have a child advocacy center. But when I juxtapose my story to my dad's story or to my Uncle Larry's story, you know, I look at how much help I got versus how little help they got, and then I say, okay, what they experienced as children was literally the worst with no support. What I experienced was horrible, but I had a lot of support, a lot of people going above and beyond. And then I look towards the future. Where do we go from here? How are we going to make this better? How are we going to start reducing the numbers of children who are being abused while erasing the stigma and the shame that surrounds the topic so that we can actually stay present enough as a society to do something about the issue?
Sasha, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you for having us here.
Filmmaker Sasha Joseph Neulinger and Abby, thank you for being here as well.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Abby Newman is CEO and Executive Director of Mission Kids. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Beneath Philadelphia's abandoned viaduct railroad tracks north of Chinatown, a sound and video installation tells the forgotten stories of women who lived in the neighborhood over the past 300 years. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on a temporary public art project called Unsung.
This droning sound you're hearing reverberates against the stones of an arched overpass under the old viaduct rail bed. They are electronically manipulated voices of singers reciting stories of four women. They're imagined characters based on the history of the Callow Hill neighborhood, sometimes called Chinatown North. One artist on this project, Matthew Sueb, says they were asked by the city's mural arts program to create an installation about the neighborhood's history.
It was pretty immediately apparent to us that there were people that were not represented in the, you know, sort of capital H historical record, and they were women. We asked for additional research. What about women in the neighborhood? What have they been doing for the past 300 years?
Sadly, most of those articles did talk about prostitution and sex workers.
That is Sueb's collaborator, Nadia Hiranaka, who discovered that in the 18th and 19th centuries, this part of town was a red light district. It also was home to immigrants, many of them forced or tricked into coming to America to work in sweatshops, laundries, and brothels. The artist gave historical texts to singers who recorded melodic recitations. The images of those singers are projected onto the walls of this tunnel. It's covered in grit, grime, and decades-old mineral deposits. The result is Unsung, a one-time-only installation of sound and video happening Friday night. The sound was designed by Nadia Poteo, who manipulated the voices to the point where words are sometimes totally abstracted. She wants people to experience the history and the tunnel viscerally.
Yeah, I come hang out in the tunnel to hear the acoustics. I sing in there. That's how I've been imagining as I'm composing, because it's sort of impossible to know until you're in there.
The effect of this installation is a spooky one, with ghostly projections, fog machines, and ominous atmospheric sounds. But the artists say this is not about Halloween. Rather, it's about remembering centuries of women who have been forgotten. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.